Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the origins of MI5, the British Security Service, the sister service to MI6, Britain's Overseas Intelligence Service, and the context in 1909 in which MI5 was created. Now, the thing that always complicates matters with intelligence histories is that you have official and unofficial versions. Official versions obviously come from official archives, but there are always limits on what the historian can and cannot write. They have to be go through all sorts of vetting processes. Unofficial versions are supposedly uninhibited by this, but then again, they tend to have less access to useful and interesting things. So with intelligence histories, you kind of have to get what you can from them and take what you read with something of a pinch of salt. This comes from Defence of the Realm by Christopher Andrew. And Christopher Andrew, if you guys are fans of intelligence history, wrote the Mitrokhin Archive along with Vasily Mitrokhin, which was an enormous haul of secret Soviet files, which were brought out, smuggled out of the Soviet Union after the end of the Cold War, and the British were fortunate enough at their at one of their embassies in the Baltic states to have Mitrokhin essentially walk in with suitcases of information, which they happily spirited back home to the UK. So the follow up. Both the Mitrokhin Archive books are a really, really interesting interesting reads. But this is the official history of MI5. So the Security Service, MI5, and the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, or MI6 as it was known, both began operations in October 1909 as one organisation, the Secret Service Bureau. And this was in premises that were rented by a detective, private detective, the retired Chief Inspector Edward Drew, on Victoria Street in London. The two officers who staffed it, who later have kind of gone down in sort of intelligence history and have been variously fictionalised by Ian Fleming and the likes, were Commander Mansfield Cumming, or C, and Vernon Kell. And the two of them met in October 1909. Cumming's diary said where they had a yarn over the future and agreed to work together for the success of the cause. What cause was he talking about? The security of Great Britain, which was, in the eyes of the Liberal government at the time, coming in under increasing strain from an ever more assertive and aggressive Germany. Britain's press, the popular publishing of the time, pulp novels and plays, all focused on the alarming threat of German spies in Britain. How many German spies there actually were in Britain is very difficult to ascertain, probably far fewer than the public imagination liked to believe. But the issue of naval secrets and the naval arms race that was ongoing between Britain and Germany caused for a great deal of heightened tension and anxiety. The creation of the Secret Service Bureau was down to the decisions of a particular subcommittee, the Committee of Imperial Defence, which was the chief governmental body for planning the defence of Great Britain and the rest of the British Empire. The committee had been told in March that year by Herbert Asquith, the Prime Minister, to, and I quote, "consider the nature and extent of foreign espionage that is at present taking place within this country and the danger to which it might expose us." The reason why Asquith was asking the committee to create organisations to answer this question was because of the heightened sense of alarm and anxiety about foreign subversion. On the 24th of July, the committee reported to Asquith and said, "The evidence which was produced left no doubt in the minds of the subcommittee that an extensive system of German espionage exists in this country and that we have no organisation for keeping in touch with that espionage and for accurately determining its extent or objectives." This isn't to say that Britain had no history of counter-espionage or had no track record in dealing with foreign undesirables. The British special branch that had existed since as an arm of the CID, Criminal Investigation Department, of the Metropolitan Police for many decades before 1900 had a very good track record of keeping tabs on and arresting and often imprisoning foreign subversives. The anarchist movement across Europe that flocked to London as they saw it as a safe place to hunker down, particularly from parts of the Russian Empire, often had special branch officers tailing them and keeping eyes on them. And special branch officers also kept close relations with other European counter-subversive police organisations. It's important to remember, of course, that MI5 and MI6 are not police forces. They are civil servants. They are part of the kind of the machinery of government. They don't have powers of arrest. Instead, they carry out jobs that are assigned to them ultimately by government ministers, the Home Secretary and the Foreign Secretary, respectively. The view that Britain gave to the outside world about its intelligence capabilities was quite different. There was an entire generation of spy novelists in the Edwardian era, such as William Le Coe, who made a fictionalised version, sort of the Edwardian sort of Ian Fleming in a way, that the British Secret Service was amongst the most sophisticated and widespread in the world. Le Coe said to his readers, "The British Secret Service, although it's never so prominently before the public as those unscrupulous agents provocateurs of France and Russia, is nevertheless equally active. It works in silence and secrecy, yet many are its successful counterplots against the machinations of England's enemies." This was largely fictional. Le Coe had also been something of a kind of a fantasist and believed that he had been part of these tales of derring do, which certainly wasn't the case. The book in Secrets of the Foreign Office that he wrote in 1903, he presented himself as the kind of the main protagonist, the amazingly titled secret agent Duckworth Drew. And the plot of the book was a kind of thinly veiled anti-French jingoism. And it's interesting that this is just on the eve of the Entente Cordiale, when there is this fundamental shift in Anglo-French relations, which happens in 1904, and the entire axis of European politics begins to shift as the as Germany is seen as the more significant threat. So novels about the villainous French are replaced by novels about the terrifying threat of Germany. Another significant writer of the time is, of course, Rudyard Kipling, who created a fictional portrayal of the Great Game, the long war of agents and spies in the Himalayas on the northern frontier of the British Raj against the Russians, who were making all sorts of inroads into Afghanistan and Persia. And once again, Rudyard Kipling gave the impression that the British intelligence network was a vast and powerful and complex and ultimately unknowably brilliant system. And this certainly wasn't the case. He referred to it as the great game that never ceases day and night throughout India. So the reality was quite different. Britain had a relatively small and poorly funded set of military and naval intelligence departments. They had little capacity to collect secret intelligence, few agents, and virtually nobody there to sift the intelligence and make sense of it. The Metropolitan Police Special Branch, as I previously mentioned, was founded in 1883, and it was mainly there to counter the threat from Irish Republican terrorism, from the Fenians, who had carried a mainland terror campaign to towns and cities in England. But also the relationship between the Fenians and the European anarchist movement, which was a kind of a complicated one, and one not based on a kind of a complete and equal understanding, also drew special branch into to keep an eye on European anarchists in London. All three of these organisations were so fringe and so minor that they had little clout in Whitehall. They were not listened to by mandarins or members of Parliament particularly. And the one comparison is quite apt. Spencer Wilkinson, who was the first professor of war at Oxford University, said that the War Office's use of in their intelligence department during the Boer War from 1892 was rather like a man who kept a small brain for occasional use in his waistcoat pocket and ran his head by clockwork. And the fact that the Boer War had been such a hard-won and rather Pyrrhic victory would tend to suggest that intelligence needed a significant overhaul. Any pressure for reform of the intelligence system fizzled out once the war ended in 1902 and the immediate crisis appeared to have passed. Instead, a kind of a complacency settled back into the army and the civil service, saying, well, you know, we managed to win it without any of this this unnecessary stuff. And if you look forward by a decade to the beginnings of the First World War, again, there's a similar sort of conservatism with a small c about other kinds of innovations, technological innovations, things like aircraft, that really have to prove themselves long-term on the battlefield.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Before they're accepted as military orthodoxy by anyone at all. The first beginnings of intelligence and counterintelligence departments emerged in 1903. They were extremely small parts of the Directorate of Military Operations within the War Office. One was called MO2, the other was called MO3. MO2 being Foreign Intelligence, and MO3 was the direct predecessor of MI5. And these organisations were... The fact that they are so underfunded gives you a clue as to how significant they were seen as being. They were really kind of concessions towards intelligence rather than intelligence work themselves. The head of the special branch was given the task of carrying out secret investigations for both organisations, and became later the chief detective in the security service, in MI5, because of course civil servants needed actual policemen there to carry out the kind of investigative work that they were actually legally entitled to do. The detective in question, one William Melville, resigned from Special Branch. His appointment to MO3 wasn't announced; it was kept secret. And the Times reported on the day that Scotland Yard lost the services of the most celebrated detective of the day. So the facade of his retirement was carried by Melville being given the MVO award, the Member of the Royal Victorian Order, and he was, on the surface of things, able to live out the life of a well thought of former public servant, but instead managed to continue working for MO3 and then later for MI5. Melville was, of course, aware about the penetration of Britain by German intelligence, but also he managed to keep relatively cordial relations with German intelligence during his particular time prior to 1909. For example, he was well acquainted with Gustav Steinhauer, who in 1901 had become head of the British section of the German Admiralty's intelligence service, the Nachrichten Abteilung, or the N service. Steinhauer had been the criminal commissioner of the Berlin police, and he was referred to as the Kaiser's spy, and had trained in America with the famous American private detective Pinkerton agency in Chicago, and he spoke English fluently with an American accent as a result, and he came with the Kaiser to England when the Kaiser visited His grandmother, Queen Victoria, in 1901, as Queen Victoria was dying, and later when the Kaiser attended Victoria's funeral and became famously, enormously jealous at the size and the prestige of the British Royal Fleet, Royal Navy. Figure of Steinhauer was always referred to as a kind of a tall, handsome, Teutonic figure, as you'd imagine. Both he and Melville met and they dined together, enjoying the kind of luxuries that spies later on would dream of. Unfortunately for fans of British espionage, the reality of the kind of the high living of that is depicted in Ian Fleming novels of the kind of the conspicuous consumption of James Bond later on in the decade in the 50s and 60s was not the experience and hasn't been the experience of most secret intelligence officers. In fact, the rather drab, dreary, bleak world of Le Carré novels is far more accurate. But you had Melville taking his German opposite number to dinner at the Strand, and over fine wines and cigars, the sort of thing that kind of in your imagination rather hope happens. And the two of them were chiefly interested in stopping Russian and other European anarchists and nihilists from carrying out assassinations. The number of assassinations carried out against European heads of state successfully in the second half of the 19th century is actually quite staggering. Obviously, figures like Alexander II in 1881 stand out, but there were a large number of attempted and indeed successful assassination attempts. So Melville, having been formerly of Special Branch, was very keen to do whatever it took to prevent these sorts of things from happening. Not just German intelligence, but Russian intelligence was closely monitored in the first decade of the 20th century. The relations between Russia were, in theory, warming in this time, but after the disaster of the Russo-Japanese War, the Russian intelligence services, previously known as the Third Section and then renamed the Okhrana, were led by an extraordinary figure, Pyotr Rachkovsky. And if you read Alex Butterworth's amazing book, The World That Never Was, it gives you a very interesting and complicated history of Rachkovsky, who was, without a doubt, one of the kind of the great spy masters of the 19th century. Often when Rachkovsky would visit London, he would station himself in the Savoy Hotel with his entourage of bodyguards and agents. And Melville knew that he would be there. Rachkovsky came and visited Melville at Scotland Yard when he was chief of when he was a special branch officer. And it was no secret to Melville and to his colleagues that one of the ways in which Rachkovsky and the Okhrana worked in the West was that they would carry out false flag operations and agent provocateur operations, bombings and assassinations that appeared to have the hallmark of anarchists upon them, but in reality were carried out by Russian agents. In addition to this, it's likely that Rachkovsky was the creator of the fabricated, completely false protocols of the Elders of Zion, which were supposedly the minutes of a meeting by Jewish Zionists for a takeover of the world. The protocols, obviously, being the kind of the founding text of 20th century violent anti-Semitism, and praised, obviously, by the likes of Hitler and others. However, between 1905 and 1907, there is a pivot from focusing on Russian to German espionage. And within the popular press and within political discourse in Britain, the spectre of Germany as a danger dramatically increases. There were all sorts of anecdotal stories by supposedly well-meaning members of the public about suspicious Germans they may have met and Germans they'd seen on trains who seemed to be up to no good, and German neighbours who were acting in strange ways, often entirely innocently. And obviously there were actually a large number of German emigres and business people and others working and living in Britain entirely peaceably. Melville believed in 1906 that he'd found a group of German spies in Epping. He said, "I mentioned to the superintendent of police at Epping that the Germans might be spies. He laughed at this idea as being ridiculous, adding, 'Spies? What could they spy here?' Argument was useless. The facts remained that undoubtedly they were spies, and their business, I should say, was to become thoroughly conversant with the routes from the sea coast to London, and thus to be able to guide a German army landed in this country." And this was a kind of significant part of British anxieties, and you can see it in novels like Erskine Childers' The Riddle of the Sands. Now, how much there was a coherent plan or a coherent intelligence gathering operation to create information that would help an invasion of Britain is unknown, and we shall delve further into intelligence histories on this pretty soon. But what is clear is that there were anxieties about this, and perhaps these reflected wider anxieties about Britain's role in the world, and Britain's place in the world, and Britain's relative decline of Britain's advantages over competitors like Germany in terms of economics, industry, and military power by the end of the 19th century. So perhaps the beginnings of MI5 and our intelligence services were based more in the worries and fears of the British than in the actual threats that enemies posed. Not to suggest that there were none of those, but certainly it's possible for policy to be guided by all manner of kind of anxieties and illusions, as even it is today. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and you can check out some of my more long-form history writing and journalism on our Patreon page. You may even want to become a patron. It would certainly help the podcast to continue going and being the success that it is. If you can do so, then check out the link that goes with this podcast, and I'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.